An interview with Mr. Wade Krismer, March 29, 1976, conducted by Mary McLean.
Mr. Krismer, how did you choose journalism as an occupation?
I can't exactly say that it was by accident, but it was a consequence of circumstances, Mrs. McLean. I was a student at Mount St. Mary's Prep School back in 25, when I began to work on the Emmitsburg Chronicle. I was at Mount St. Mary's College, or rather Mount St. Mary's Prep School in Emmitsburg, and worked on the newspaper after school and during the summer. At the same time, serving as a correspondent for the Baltimore newspapers, particularly the Sun papers and the Associated Press, covering the events at Mount St. Mary's College and at St. Joseph's College, the two most important places up there, and the area in general. It proved later to have been a very fortuitous thing that I had done this work, because when the time came to get a job, I was qualified for accepting the one that was offered to me. Would you like me to give you a chronology of what happened before I came to Harford County, which is of particular interest to you? In other words, just summarize my career between the times of leaving Emmitsburg and arriving in Bel Air?
Yes, please.
It might save a lot of questions and at the same time cover the story. Well, in any case, I was a product of the Depression. My father, like a lot of people back in 1929, lost most of his money in bank crashes and things of that sort. So I was forced to leave school and was fortunate in getting a job at the Towson newspaper, which my brother was editing. I came there expecting that I was going to be, since he was the editor, that I was going to be one of the leading lights of the business, but instead of that, he gave me a broom and said that I was going to learn the business from the ground up, for which I was very grateful later on, because no matter what happened, if I should go to a newspaper for a job and they didn't have an opening as a reporter or an advertising man, I was a typesetter, linotype operator, and could go to work on that. So that I was rarely out of work, despite the fact that working in the newspaper business in those days was quite difficult. I stayed with the Union News in Towson for, I suppose, about a year and a half, when I had an opportunity to go with the old Baltimore Post, but disaster struck it. Fire burned the place down. And then later on, it was taken over by the News of America and became the News Post, throwing a great number of us newspaper people out of work. We were enterprising enough, however, to start up a sort of free distribution newspaper called the North Baltimore Home News. The editorial men served as writers and reporters and editors and so forth. And those of us who could do other things worked in other capacities. For instance, I, because I knew something about advertising, went to work on the advertising department. I stayed there for a couple of years. But by the way, this was back in the days when newspaper people were a little bit of everything. Today, a newspaper man, I'm speaking of the editorial department, will serve solely as a reporter, or he will serve as a rewrite man, or he will serve as a copy editor or something of that sort. Back in those days, however, you did general assignments. You never knew when you went in there in the morning what sort of job you were going to be called upon to do, which was a very fortunate thing and something I wish would be in practice again, but it was not. I stayed there, I suppose, a couple of years before a friend of mine, an old pal from the Baltimore Sun papers, had started a newspaper, or rather a couple of newspapers, over on the Eastern Shore. I went over to Easton and Cambridge, where he operated papers, and there again, I was a combination editorial and advertising man. And when necessity required, I pitched in and helped set type, which made me all the more valuable. I stayed there for a couple of years, probably a year, and then I had a chance to go to Washington. And I went over to Washington, and during a career of about 5 years, I think it was, in Washington, I worked on all five of the daily newspapers in Washington. In those days, you moved from place to place rather freely. By that time, the Depression had ended. A pal of mine over there on one of the papers had been given a job as managing editor of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And he asked me if I would like to go to Richmond. I had no ties holding me in Washington, so I went to Richmond. And I worked on the Richmond Times-Dispatch until Uncle Sam reached out during the period of wartime and said he needed me very badly because the war was going against us. So I came, I went into the Army. And after taking basic training, it was discovered that I had been a newspaper man, so I was given a job of editing one of the Army newspapers, Quartermaster Training Service Journal. While I was, in the meantime, I had gone to Officer Candidate School and had recklessly, and probably because I was scared not to, volunteered for overseas service. And just situated very beautifully in this cushy job as editor of this magazine, when orders came through for me to go overseas, and I wound up in the Persian Gulf Command. And even over there, I was given the job because of my background in newspapering and so forth. I was given the job of editing the newspaper over there and serving as the liaison officer. I was injured overseas and came back before the war was over, just a few months before that, got a job on the Baltimore News Post. I worked there for about a year. Didn't like having to live in Baltimore. Being a small town boy, I wanted to bring up my family. At that time, I had a wife and two children. Wanted to bring them up in a small town. And an opportunity came along to come out here to Bel Air as editor and advertising manager of the Old Hartford Gazette. And I accepted the job very gladly. Stayed with the Gazette for a period of about a year, then decided I'd like to get into advertising again because there was more money in it. Went to Baltimore and worked on an advertising agency, still living in Bel Air, and then as a consequence of the requests of local merchants, I decided to put out a shopping paper for the reason that Harford County in those days had five very small newspapers. Not particularly small, he just was better than average size, for instance, but there was no one paper which adequately covered the county at large. Aberdeen, Havre de Grace, Edgewood, Joppa, and Bel Air, so that I put out this free distribution newspaper called the Hartford Leader, and served as a combination advertising and newspaper man on it until the paper, I was persuaded by the then owner of the Hartford Gazette to relinquish that and come back with the Gazette. The Gazette, by the way, in the meantime, had grown considerably in size so that its circulation was just about adequate to cover the county. I stayed there for about 6 months until he, Mr. Paul Capron, sold that paper out to the Aegis. And that, the combination of the Aegis and the Gazette, gave Harford County a very adequate circulation so that somebody who wished to put one ad in a newspaper and reach practically let us say about 80% of the people in the county, which was a good circulation. I went with the Aegis. They picked up my Gazette contract, and I have been with them ever since. I was there for, I think, precisely 24 years to the day, or just about that time, until I retired last July. Ready?
Yes. You've had experience with various types of newspaper. Could you comment on the Hearst type of journalism as to what made it so successful or popular?
Mary, I've never believed that the Hearst type of journalism was as black as it was painted. Perhaps I got in at the time that he was a little bit more mellow than he had been initially, but I would say that if there is such a thing as what is commonly known as Hearst journalism, it is now being typified, and to an extreme degree, by these scandal papers, these tabloids that you see on sale. I won't name any of them. In the drugstores and such, and newsstands and such places, and that it goes back to the innate desire on the part of people to learn everything scandalous. It is not confined to journalism alone, but simply like the gossip of your neighbors. I believe that people would rather hear something scandalous about you and me than something pleasant about us. That's probably typical of myself as well as the people that I'm talking about. But Hearst did an awful lot of good for the reason that he had the courage to unearth things which other newspapers thought that they were being polite and ignoring. I guess that is the reason why things are popular. People want to know, and he told them. He did, it's true, print, so I've been told, although I can't recall any instance where it happened in my case. He did print some things which were, if not exactly untrue, were a little bit dubious, but it caused people to think and to investigate, just as you might say of the people who unearthed the Watergate scandal. A lot of people thought that that was particularly just vicious, and yet a tremendous amount of good has come out of it. And I think Mr. Hearst contributed a great deal to that type of journalism.
Mr. Christmer, did you find the Aegis to be a typical small-town paper?
Mary, there's no such thing as a typical small-town paper. Back when I began, and to a certain extent today, there are all sorts of papers. Primarily, however, a newspaper was a printer. A man had a printing business, and he printed letterheads and billheads and envelopes and things like that for his broadsides and things of that sort for his neighbors, and made his money that way, and the newspaper was a mere incident to it. On the other hand, there were newspapers where some wealthy politician or group of men who wanted to influence politics would put out a paper. They were not particularly interested in making money, but in disseminating information which would make money for themselves. Also, there's a type of newspaper which is a sort of tax dodge. Now, they have existed in Harford County, and I'm reluctant to say that they still do, but there are men who, wishing to toy with newspapers and newspapering, and promote their own ideas, will, wealthy men that is, use the newspaper to disseminate their own political thinking, and if they lose money, just take it off of their income tax, just as some people we know operate farms, horse farms, and just farms, giving themselves a place to live and luxuriate in country life. And if they lose money off of it, can just let Uncle Sam pick up the tab.
In the almost 25 years you've been employed by the Aegis, there have been a great many changes in the county and in the newspaper business itself. Could you remark on some of these changes?
Mrs. McLean, that's been the consequence of the growth of the community. I saw it happen 30-some years ago, I guess it was, when I was in Towson. Towson, when I went there, was just a little town, completely separated from Baltimore, and the city began to grow out into the county, so that now that you can't tell where it is separated. And with its growth, the newspaper grew, until it began to resemble a city paper. Now, that same thing has happened in the last 25 years with the Aegis. The Aegis, when I went with it, had a circulation of about 6,000 or 7,000. Today, its circulation is around 25. It is a, in size, that is the physical size of the paper, it went from about 12 pages to now over 100, an average of over 100. So that it is beginning to resemble a city paper far more than weekly newspapers ever did before. And I think that, I know definitely that it is happening in all suburban communities in and around Baltimore, east, west, north, and south of the city. It's happening around Washington. It's happening around Richmond. Of those three cities in particular, I know, and it must be happening everywhere in the country. People are, they're still weekly newspapers, but they are much, they much more resemble the dailies.
Do you consider this healthy? Is this better for the community to have a larger paper?
Oh, certainly. The larger the paper, the better able the paper is to provide news to its subscribers and the necessary circulation, which without which advertisers can't get any benefit from their ads. So that if a newspaper doesn't have big circulation, it can't get advertising, and if it doesn't can't get advertising, it cannot afford to put out a good newspaper. It's a case of mutual back scratching. But the growth of the quality of the newspaper depends upon its ability to do it. A man who takes in only $1,000 a week cannot afford to spend $5,000 a week for the hiring of reporters and editors and so forth, the use of photography and the like. The bigger the paper, the bigger the paper, the better the paper, really. If all things being equal, and the man, the publisher, being an honest individual.
Chrismer, what changes do you see in editorialist since the beginning of your career?
Well, nowadays, Mary, a newspaper man, even somebody who comes with the Aegis, will have been trained before he comes there. In my day, you went there and learned. I, for instance, had only such training as I got working on the college newspaper and in the English composition classes that I took at school, whereas now the people who will come to work for, say, the Aegis will have previously been specifically trained in courses in journalism at his school. My daughter is at Towson State College now and is taking a course in communications, where she is being actively trained by newspaper people, radio people, and television people, and even in the making of movies, so that when she, if she graduates, as I hope she will, next fully expect she will be able to go somewhere and have some knowledge of some actual, definite, properly given knowledge of what she is to do, whereas I just did, you might say, what I had trained myself to do. There was no one to train you. Very, very few. Of course, you grew up little by little. I went to the little newspaper, and as a consequence of what I had learned on the little newspaper, I got a job on the Metropolitan Dailies. But my training was my own. There had been nobody who trained me. But even she goes off to work on various projects as public relations assistants for the Orioles, for instance, and she's worked on newspapers, and she's worked a little bit in radio and television stations. Something that, and yet she's doing it all as part of her college training, which was something that was not available to her unfortunate father in his day.
You talked about the past of journalism. What changes do you foresee for the future of newspapers?
Well, Mary, that's more or less predictable in that we know that electronics, computers and so forth, are completely changing the entire thing. For instance, putting this interview on tape is just one example. I understand that you are now able, if you have the equipment, to pick up an electronically printed newspaper delivered to your house by way of television, so to speak. And I know that they exist, and I know that they're going to grow and grow and grow. And I believe, from what I read recently in a magazine or newspaper, that the day will come, and probably within the next 50 years, when there will be no such thing as printed newspapers or even printed books. A library, I don't know which one it was, is unable to house one-tenth of all of the material that it would like to house in the form of printed books. It's all being put on microfilms, you know that. Newspapers and the files of newspapers in the libraries nowadays are mostly on microfilm, where they occupy, say, 1/50th of the space that would be taken up by the files of the papers themselves. And books won't be printed as they are now. You won't be able to pick up a book like this one here and hold it in your hands and read it. You will go to a library or have your own scanner, or whatever you call it, microfilm printer, and taking a little bitty box out of a cabinet, we'll put that onto the machine, and the page will flash itself in front of you. And I don't believe that in 50 years, papers or books or magazines or any type of today's conventional type of printing will be known to us. It'll all be computerized, and that will be the method. I know that certain companies are doing that now. As a potential author, I have had correspondence with people who've written to me saying that they will publish my book on microfilm and save an awful lot of money that way, that the libraries would be more interested in buying it on microfilm than they would be in buying it as a book. So that books, like all of the hundreds of them in my own library here, will be curiosities, truly.
As an author yourself, how do you feel about this change?
Well, I suppose it's inevitable. I will resist it, just as I haven't resisted seeing what is now known as cold-type printing, where you don't use any linotype machines. You use a girl sitting at a machine, types something, and it's immediately transferred to the printed page. I know it's got to happen, and I will have to accept it. But an author feels, I've never had a book published, but I've had lots of things in magazines, you like to be able to pick that up and see it. The physical fact of what you created is there for you to hold in your hand, and I think I would get a bigger kick out of seeing my multi-volume Maryland history, which hopefully will be my magnum opus. I'd much rather see it in the form of three big volumes than on a little bitty reel of tape that you can't see unless you laboriously, page by page, put it on tape, or rather show it on the screen from the microfilm. But I'm not going to be selfish and say that I hope that doesn't happen. I know it's going to happen. I know it's better for all concerned, and I'm satisfied. Having been a reader myself ever since I was probably 4 or 5 years old, I can't recall a time when I couldn't read. I've loved books and buy as many of them as I probably can't afford. And I will hate to see them go, but I do know that they're going to have to. I fully believe that they will. And that because it'll be a sort of gradual thing, nobody will mind it too badly.
How do you feel this computerizing and microfilming will affect photography, since you yourself are a photographer?
Well, it's bound to have some effect upon it, but nothing will ever replace the original photograph itself. I did considerable of it for a period of about 5 years. I used to send photographs to exhibitions all over the world, and I know that I got a much bigger kick out of knowing that something which I had actually executed in my own dark room was being hung, for instance, in the Tate Gallery over in London, than I would if I knew that it was simply there and microfilm for somebody to dig out and look at on a screen. I was in London not long ago and went to the Tate, and I know that seeing Rembrandt and Van Gogh and any of the others in the original would never replace any picture. I'd seen thousands and thousands and thousands of beautifully executed printed pictures of the originals, but nothing will ever take the place of the original. And I have an idea that while photographs will probably be transferred to microfilm along with the conventional printed material, they'll never completely replace the photograph itself. And I'm no longer in photography. I gave that up when I got interested in the Civil War. Well, nobody's going to destroy the Rembrandts, and nobody's going to destroy any of the things of that nature. They're going to continue to exist, and somehow or other they're going to have to be stored and arrangements made to exhibit the originals, because people will forever be interested in the originals, and hopefully they'll always be interested in the original photograph rather than a printed reproduction of a graphically printed reproduction of the photograph.
How did your own interest in photography develop?
Well, as a consequence, I suppose, Mary, of being unhappy with the results that I got back from commercial photographers. I thought that my pictures should look better than they did when they came back from the drugstore. And talking this over with people in the photographic business, I was told that there'd never be, nobody else would ever do as good work on with my negatives as I might be able to do myself if I was willing to take the pain. And fortunately, having a very good friend in the photographic business, he helped me, encouraged me, taught me, and little by little I got to the point where I could do pretty good photography. And as a contemporary and good friend a rival, you might say, of Aubrey Bodine, had the very distinct pleasure of beating him in a couple of contests, which led my youngsters to go around telling everybody that I was a better photographer than Aubrey Bodine, which of course wasn't so. It just meant that on one particular occasion, some group of judges liked a picture of mine better than they liked Aubrey's, but 9 times out of 10, Aubrey would beat the pants off, mind the indelicate expression. But I did it because I felt that I could do it better than the other guy who was not particularly interested in it. But of course, that applies, that same thinking applies to anything of your own. You would do a better job on something in which concerned you than anybody you might hire to do it.
What determined your choice of subject?
Ms. McLean, it appears that there's not going to be room enough to answer this question on this side, so suppose we turn it over and let me answer it on the opposite one. Well, primarily, I wanted to take an interesting picture. You can tell by just looking at the pictures hanging on the wall in this office that there is an infinite variety of what I at least thought was interesting material. I wanted it to be composed attractively. That was a requisite in pictorial photography. But I wanted it, if I could, to tell us a little bit of a story. There's a picture of an old mill. There's a picture of a local church. There's a picture of my wife sitting at the kitchen table. There's a picture of youngsters flying a kite. There's a picture of cows in the local field. There's a farm. There's an old gent plowing. Those are ones that just by happenstance are here now, but underneath this table where we're talking, there are hundreds and hundreds of others that are not like that. But also there was, at the time I was in photography, a great deal of dispute between what was good pictorial photography and what was not. There was a school of thought that believed that a picture must tell a story to be interesting, and others who believed that it only needed to be beautifully composed, and regardless of whether it told a story or not, it was a good photograph. I recall particularly one time when Aubrey Bodine and I took one side of that argument and debated it with two other photographers from the Baltimore Camera Club, and it was a moot question, never properly decided. But I think generally nowadays that the idea of, which you might call journalistic photography, has gotten deeper roots in the pictorial photography, the kind that are exhibited in art museums, than there was prior to that time. That was about 20 years ago, I remember. Nowadays, pictures that people like are pictures that tell a story rather more than those that are primarily pretty.
How did you happen to give up photography?
Well, primarily, Mary, solely because of a lack of time. I found myself becoming very much interested, more so than I had ever been, and although I had been interested in the Civil War all my life, I got to the point where I simply did not have time for both. I could not do the research in the Civil War that I wanted to do and at the same time do the photography. So that while I still have half a dozen or so cameras and every so often take some pictures, I am having the work done by other people and not doing it in my own darkroom. I solo gave away all the darkroom equipment and got involved in the Civil War.
How did your interest in the Civil War come about?
I can't recall a time when I was not interested in the Civil War, for the reason I was born in Emmitsburg, as I've said, which is about 8 miles away from the Gettysburg battlefield, and my great-grandfather owned the farm, the Cadore Farm, which was his name, over which Pickett's charge was made at the Battle of Gettysburg. And as a youngster, back in the horse and buggy days, I spent many a Sunday afternoon over there playing on the battlefield at a time when hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of relics of the battle were still around on the farm. I wanted to bring those things home, but my mother, of course, treated things with familiarity breeding contempt, wouldn't let me bring those dirty things into the house, and neither would my grandmother. And, of course, we weren't permitted to keep them. Now I go out and pay hundreds of dollars for the things that we kicked aside in order to make room for to shoot marbles or something of the sort. But my genuine interest in it my active historical interest came about as a consequence of not being able to find out what I wanted to know about the Civil War, particularly Emmitsburg's role in, I mean, not Emmitsburg's, what am I talking about? Maryland's role in the Civil War. There's hardly anything, as a matter of fact, make the practice of saying that there is nothing you can say about the Civil War which is not subject to dispute. And that particularly applies to Maryland, which was the most controversial state in the Union. And I couldn't find out things. Everything I found out was being contradicted by something else that I would read. So that I made up my mind, if it were possible, the Lord let me live long enough, I would gather up all of the information I possibly could on the Civil War and put it into one work. Well, over the period of the past 20 years, I've accumulated more than 2 million words of notes on the subject and have, I suppose, 100 or more books that I have read and annotated with little pieces of paper stuck in at various places from which pages I expect to extract more and more notes, and heaven only knows how long it may be before I can actually begin the writing of it. But it was that, the fact that nobody knows, just what did happen here. It's an unpleasant subject. There's nothing you can say about the Civil War that won't make one side or another mad. Every time I've gone to lecture on the subject somewhere, I've had in the audience friends of mine who were ardent Confederates, and I've had in the audience friends of mine who were ardent Yankee supporters. And if I told the truth about any subject on which I was writing, I wound up with nobody speaking to me when it was all over, because it's a very unpleasant thing, and it was Maryland in particular, I think, was full of hypocrisy. I hope to be able to prove it. I expect that it will, but whether or not I can reach any conclusions, I don't know. But I'm wandering from the subject. You simply asked me how I got interested in it, and it was a sort of little by little thing.
Your family was uniquely involved in the Civil War. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I've already said that my great-grandfather, George Cadore, was the owner of the Cadore Farm at Gettysburg. He also happened to be captured by the Confederates for reasons which nobody, the most able Gettysburg historians, have not been able to determine certainly. He spent 18 months in various Confederate prisons, came back to Gettysburg, and lived less than 2 weeks before he was in his grave as a consequence of the ailments that he contracted while in the prisons. I don't know that that lent me a greater interest in the Civil War than I might conventionally have, or whether it was simply my curiosity as a newspaper man and somebody interested in...
Mr. Christmer, how do you go about tracking down an article or a piece of information about the Civil War, and does one collectible interest you more than another?
Oh, there are literally hundreds of sources of material, auctions of books, autographs, documents, maps, letters, and things of that sort are being held constantly. I just this morning's mail received from an auction house in Baltimore a catalog of Civil War material that's going to be auctioned off in a month or so. I'll attend that, and if there's anything in it that I don't have or I think can be useful, I will try to buy it. Also, of course, there are hundreds and hundreds of antiquarian booksellers in America, and all over the world for that matter, and I get the catalogs of all of those people that I can learn about and buy from them. Also, you find things in antique shops, and while I am primarily interested in getting paper material which augment the history of the war, that is, books and pamphlets and newspapers and letters and documents and so forth, you will find curiosities such as little patriotic covers. Those are envelopes which have a message printed on them and which were in profuse use during the Civil War. I don't think anybody ever wrote a letter, oh yes, of course they did, but not very many, who didn't use a printed envelope conveying some sort or another of patriotic message. The Yankees would libel, I guess it were possible to libel them. They would say scandalous things about the Confederates. The Confederates, on the other hand, would say scandalous things about the Yankees. There were hundreds and hundreds, or actually thousands upon thousands of broadsides, little sheets of paper which people published. There were pamphlets. Every time a politician delivered a speech in Congress, he had the speech printed in pamphlet form and sent back to his constituents, because of course there was no way of reaching them on radio or television, so it was all put on printed material. And primarily I have sought to buy the rarer or scarce, rare meaning something which only 8 or 10 might exist, whereas scarce means that they're limited to a few hundreds in a few libraries around the country. Yeah, I would try to find that kind of material, but as I've said, you never knew what might provide you with a piece of information. Letters, of course, were a very good source, and I have thousands of letters written by both Confederates and Yankees, important ones and obscure ones, which have given me a trifle of a fact. But the trouble is, with the bloomin' Civil War, that no sooner do you think you have established a fact as a consequence of some so-called authoritative source before you turn another page, open another book, read another newspaper, and find that so-called authoritative thing contradicted with as much authority as you thought you had found that oppositely just a few minutes before. That's the bane of a researcher's existence, and is one of the reasons why there will probably never be an end to Civil War historiography. More books, I understand, have been written on the Civil War than, well, I know more books have been written on the Civil War than on any other aspect of American history, and it has been said that more books have been written on the Civil War than on any other subject than religion. After trying for years to run to earth all of the valuable ones, those that I think can contribute to what I know, I'm beginning to believe that it is right. And more books on the Civil War are now still being published than on any other phase of American history. Now, when I speak of the Civil War, I don't mean of the period from Sumter to Appomattox. That was only the fighting part of the Civil War. The Civil War goes back to, in my opinion, to the very first objection on anybody's part to American slavery, or perhaps to the very landing in America of the first slave. And as we all know, the Civil War isn't over yet. We know that aspects of the Civil War, that is the freedom of the slaves, they've got the actual political freedom, but the blacks, unfortunately, in my opinion, have not gotten the full freedoms to which they were supposed to have been entitled more than 100 years ago, which is why you can keep on writing about it and why historians will keep on writing about it till doomsday. I read recently that all aspects of American history, the one subject of American history where classes in colleges are always filled up, are those classes which deal with the Civil War, or what is actually called the middle period of American history, probably starting at about 1830 and running through to, well, certainly to the end of the so-called Reconstruction days, although Reconstruction isn't over yet, as you know only too well by reading your daily papers.
Why did you first begin to write about the Civil War, Mr. Krismer, and can you give us some idea of things you've written and lectures you've given so far?
Mary, I read hundreds and hundreds of books on the Civil War, and I was, because I suppose I can't get the idea of being an editor out of my head, I can see every mistake people have made. And I knew that books that were being written, particularly during the days of the first days of the centennial, that's back in 1961, were full of mistakes. So I communicated with the editor of the Civil War Times and told him about some of these mistakes that I had unearthed, and he agreed that a summary of some of them might make an interesting article. So, under the title of With Malice Towards None But Careless Editors, I did a piece for the Civil War Times back in, well, doesn't matter when, I suppose, but let's find it here if we can. Back in November of 1960, under that title, hung on the peg of some cannon that were on display up at Gettysburg, where a round shell was piled up next to a weapon, a cannon, that fired a cylindrical shell, and right next to it was a cannon that took the round shot where the cylindrical shells were piled. And with that as the picture peg on which the article was hung, I wrote this article. After that, Mr. Fowler, the editor, and I agreed that Maryland had played a very unusual part in the Civil War, but that very few people knew how important it was, and I hit upon the idea that the Baltimore riots, which occurred on April the 19th, 1861, had focused, in which, by the way, the first people killed in anger in the Civil War died on the streets of Baltimore, had focused the attention of the federal government upon the importance of Maryland and brought to bear upon Maryland the federal restraint which kept Maryland eventually from seceding. And that is still a fact, that if Maryland had not been restrained from taking the political action which most of its people wanted to take, we would have seceded along with Virginia, but they did not. So that was the second thing that I wrote for them. After that, I wrote scores of book reviews and various other articles, which I can't find here now. And also, I made contributions on various subjects to a magazine called the Lincoln Herald, and I think, if, with your permission, we'll come back to that a little later. I was asked by the editor of the American Book Collector to do a large-scale overall review of the Civil War Centennial and appraisal of its literature, in which I wrote this 1, 2, 3, 4-page article about the books that most people were going to be reading. As for lectures, I lectured at Gettysburg on the hundreds of very intriguing pamphlets about the subject of Gettysburg. And while they were usually treated with contempt by most people, most historians, I found by researching them that they contained a lot of information that was not available anywhere else. And I gave this lecture to Gettysburg College. Also, I knew that no attention had ever been given to the women in Maryland, and there's very little known about them, particularly those of Union sympathies. So a lecture that I presented to the Bel Air American History Club, and I've since given to lots and lots of others, was called The Confederate Women of Maryland and the Civil War, about the Carey sisters, one of whom, by the way, had, if you do not know it or our listeners don't know it, wrote or put to music Maryland, My Maryland. That was Jennie Carey. She and her sister Hetty, who was the most beautiful woman in the Confederacy, about whom books could be written and should be written, and her cousin Connie Carey, who was one of the literary lights of the Civil War, the three Maryland women. They had left Baltimore at the request of the government and gone to Richmond and lived there, socialites and important people in the South during the war. Another one, and possibly the most interesting and, in a sense, an all-embracing condensation of my own history, was called Maryland, Beleaguered Neutral of the Civil War. Maryland, Beleaguered Neutral of the Civil War, which ended up with the remark that, as it was, Maryland stayed in the Union, nominally, that is, for she was in it, but seldom of it. Her pro-Confederate sympathy was evident throughout the war, betrayed by the repeated votes of her elected national representatives, two of whom were arrested for treason, by her newspapers, 20 or more of which were suppressed or suspended, and by her citizens, nearly 100 of whom went to jail for various crimes against the government, and by the 10,000 or so of her sons who fought for the Confederacy. But that did not take Maryland through the war, but only to the beginning. And the concluding paragraph is, "But let's leave her here, on the brink of the conflict, a poor, bewildered, and beleaguered would-be neutral of the Civil War." I think I've covered this not quite so adequately a little earlier in this interview, but this is the way I prefaced a remark, a lecture I gave at the Hopkins about 12 or 15 years ago, that Dr. John Hope Franklin, the noted authority on American Negro history, said, "It takes a person of great courage to tell the history of America precisely as it is." Dr. Franklin could have said that this applies especially to the role played by Maryland in the Civil War. Maryland was no better or worse than other states in or out of the Union at that time, but it is certain that no history of her role, such as that on which I am engaged, will ever find popular favor with anyone in the state, Yankee or Confederate, except, I fondly hope, its dedicated scholars of no prejudiced persuasion. Now that's how I introduced my lecture at the Hopkins, and that will be, in a sense, the way I will introduce my book.
Mr. Christmer, what questions do people of Harford County most often ask you about the Civil War?
Well, because he was our best-known citizen, unfortunately, most of the questions concern John Wilkes Booth. And while practically everything that can be said about John Wilkes Booth has already been published, I have managed to find some uniquely distinctive things about him which would be of interest to Harford County, and that they were published in various issues of the Aegis. I did quite a number of them. My conclusion being, as expressed in one headline on one of the articles, that his youthful letters revealed Booth was a hard-drinking, carousing, wenching, dropout juvenile delinquent. And while that, as strange as it may seem, does not set well with an awful lot of people, it is, in my opinion, the truth about the gentleman. you will find it difficult to believe, and I'd have to go back through my files, take too much time to find it. But about 2 or 3 years ago, a young woman from a college up in Pennsylvania wrote to me, sincere in the belief that he was a lovable, very lovable character, and that what he did was for the good of the country. I wrote back, of course, scandalized, and hopefully, through what I was able to tell her, made the young lady change her opinion, but she didn't have the courtesy to write back and say so. She did. The second most frequently asked question is, what about Robert E. Lee in Maryland? Well, fortunately, I was able to do a considerable amount of research on Lee in Maryland, unearthing a few facts about him that people did not know, and was able to deliver a lecture on the subject of Lee, which even achieved accolades from the ladies of the Confederacy and the United Daughters of the Confederacy when I delivered the lecture to them. He was an admirable gentleman. I disagree with his philosophy in going with the South, but I have to admit that he was a gentleman, and that there are many kind things that can be said about him. What I did say met with their approval.
Could you briefly express your philosophy of the Civil War?
I think so. I tried to do it in a poem that I wrote for the Lincoln Herald back in the fall of 1968. It happens that in the Civil War, people who owned slaves, and if they were in states that were still in the Union, where slaves were still legal, could send that slave, by freeing him, to fight for his owner. In other words, if the owner was drafted, he could, instead of going himself, free a slave who was willing to go fight, and the slave took his place. It happened that a man over in Salisbury in 1863 sent off a man, one of his slaves, called George Roxbury. Two years later, he wrote to the War Department trying to find out what had happened to the man, and in a printed form which wandered into my possession, he was told by the War Department that the man had been killed in a skirmish near Strawberry Plain. That struck me as being highly poetic, and I wrote for this Lincoln Herald a poem which reads as follows. Killed in a skirmish near Strawberry Plain. He was only a colored man, once was a slave, not exactly a coward nor specially brave. He hoed Massa's cotton and he held Massa's horse, and he thought that his plight simply couldn't get worse. Then came Mr. Lincoln to call him to war, and George, mighty proud, said he wasn't too sore, but that he could fight and could march and could die. In any event, he would give her a try. But George disappeared, as so many had done, and George Roxbury's friends wondered where he had gone. So they asked an official. Back came the reply. Old George went to war, and old George he did die. In terse army language, but littered with pain, he was killed in a skirmish near Strawberry Plain. Now, in these last four lines of that little poem is what I hope or expect is my philosophy of the whole thing. Killed in a skirmish near Strawberry Plain. Pray God that old George has not perished in vain. If this is the reason the war had to be, let George lie long dead in the land of the free.